This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday the 24th of July on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on this week's show, we take a tour around Barcelona to see how the local design community is coping with the economic crisis.
And it's nice because we are sharing so many things in this space. We share company and we share talent, and every time there's something that you can exchange with another person.
Over at the Denver Art Museum, we visit a new exhibition on local architects Fentress. They're designers of some of the world's better airports.
The design of a building, at least for me, is like writing music. And the writing of music is for the listener. And so it's for the buildings are for the people.
Back in Europe, we stop off in the Lisbon studio of Aris Mateus Architects.
If you remember that we are only 9 million, and you see from the average how many good architects are in Portugal, it's amazing.
And as London gives itself over in its entirety to the Olympics, we head to the Design Museum for a tour of its latest exhibition, Designed to Win.
We were very lucky in that there's a very obvious way to look at sport and to use design as the lens through which to look at sport. So I think that was perhaps the genesis and the start point of the exhibition.
All that, plus we join a debate that explores the future relationship between luxury and digital technology. And we'll play a song or two too. That's all to come on this week's episode of Section D. Stay tuned. We start our journey this week in Barcelona, a city that, since the 90s and largely thanks to the Olympics, has been home to some of Europe's more experimental designers and architects. But as we're all too aware, the last few years have been harder on Spain's economy than most, and creative communities are usually the earliest victims. Barcelona's local government claims its design and architecture community has not been affected, and that the creative brand of the city is more alive than ever. Our reporter Patricia Del Hoya visited four people to hear for herself how they're faring. Alex Trochut, a graphic designer and illustrator. Mark Morrow, curator of the Otras Cosas de Villarosas Design Gallery. And local architects Anna and Eugeni Batch. Here's what they said.
Since the 90s, Barcelona had the fame of being a city of design, full of creative people, and it was perceived like a very nice place to live. But now times are changing and there is a huge economical crisis in Spain. Has it affected to Barcelona in terms of creativity? I'm meeting one of those who doesn't stop working improving the city, maybe with not much money, but with optimism and good sense of humor.
Hello, my name is Alex Trochut. I'm a graphic designer, illustrator, and basically I work a lot with letters, although it's not my specialty. Every time I try to do something different in terms of aesthetics. Maybe there's like a background that's still the same and makes everything consistent, but in terms of shape, I try to change as much as I can. Right now we are in Pamplona 89, which is an old space in Poblenou, and we are many companies here. We are all from different backgrounds. Some are more specialized in motion graphics, some are more into design or illustration. And it's nice because we are sharing so many things in this space. We share company and we share talent, and every time there's something that you can exchange with another person. Basically, it's an open space, so it's very big. We have a lot of common areas like a ping pong for playing and meeting room, like a foosball. We can also DJ a little bit. We have some decks. Besides our work activity, everyone has its own hobbies. And for example, Fernando from Divain, he's really into doing music, and he has all kinds of instruments like this. This thing, I don't know how is it called, but it sounds cool. And he also does production for music, and he has a drum. here in the studio, and he plays it sometimes. We are in the middle of Poblano, which is a place that is kind of desert. You don't have many things. There's a lack of infrastructure around here. That's why it's so cheap, so that's why we are here. It's kind of still industrial, but they are changing the environment of the place, so they are also trying to integrate a lot of creative studios in the area. One of the best and the hugest advances in art happened here in the last century, from Dalí or Picasso, Miró. You don't really see this when you are in Barcelona, when you are living here, but then you realize when you talk with somebody from outside and they are like, wow, man, like it's so different to anything else. But yeah, Barcelona is very attractive outside. And I think we really need to support that image more and more.
Well, hello, my name is Marc Morro and we are in Otras Cosas de Villarrosas. We like to say that it's mainly a design gallery. But let's start from the beginning. The first is Villarrosas. Villarrosas is a communication agency. A few years ago, like 3 years ago, the owners decided that they wanted to do another things. But we are really focusing on design. I don't know any design gallery in Barcelona that lives like a design gallery should live, which is like selling their products. Normally, there is something always on the back. In this case, there is like a communication agency. And something nice about Otras Cosas thing is that now it's a gallery, but maybe next year it could be a restaurant or it could be like a company who makes books or anything. We are not on the street, it's a principal. So that means people don't see the place, I mean, if they are walking around. So that's something which is kind of, it's nice because just people who are really interested come in. Plaza Catalunya is just right here. So it's kind of a strange area because it's just the center of the city and it's in Via Laietana, which is maybe the only street in Barcelona that doesn't look it's Barcelona. In fact, it was inspired in, well, people say New York, I don't believe that. It's more like Madrid, it's kind of really monumental street.
We are Anna and Eugeni Bach, we are architects. I am from Barcelona and Anna is from Finland. And we have a studio in Barcelona since around 2000, more or less.
Since the Causas House, well, as it was the first real built project, I think that it taught us very many things. And I think that this has made us to develop our ideas of architecture or how to make places for people to live as an open system, so that the people actually and their lives and their things and their objects have in a very natural way form the rest of the actual design process. So the design process doesn't end with the final photo, that's just the start.
Our studio is in a street called Herzegovina, which is it's a strange street in Barcelona because it's very short, actually. It's just maybe 200 meters long. And it's a strange place because many architects have come to this street. We have actually five or six other studios are in this same street, and it's a very short one. And the nice thing is that it's all open to a small park.
I think that that's the best thing of the whole neighborhood, because the neighborhood in itself lacks interest, really.
And actually, well, you can see when you look through the window, the only thing you see is green. It's everything is green, you don't see anything. If you do a small mental effort, you can think that you are in the middle of the mountain. In the Olympic Games, what Barcelona gained is that it opened the city to the sea, which was something that actually now it's difficult to believe that it was like that. But actually, people from Barcelona didn't go to the sea because it was all polluted.
It was the backyard of Barcelona.
Exactly. And right now, what the new municipality is trying is to do a similar thing, but to the mountain, no? To open the city to the mountain. But of course there is this thing that in the economical situation that we have nowadays, there are not many chances that these projects will go on.
That was Anna and Eugenie Batch talking to our reporter in Barcelona, Patricia Del Hoya. And before that, we heard Marc Morrow and Alex Troschut. Back in London, it's Olympic fever. No square or signpost is left unadorned by a banner or flag, and it's all anyone's talking about anywhere, everywhere. Down at the Design Museum, the discussion is, of course, about more than the nation's medal count. A new exhibition, Designed to Win, looks at the role design has played in enhancing sporting performance. Our reporter, Emily Aylett, donned her spikes to see what it's all about.
My name's Alex Neeson, I'm a curator at the Design Museum.
Can you just start by telling me a little bit about how the idea to host the exhibition came about?
Well, I suppose it's a very important time for sport, for London in particular at the moment, with the Olympics just around the corner. And I think a lot of museums were scratching their head, perhaps looking at ways that they can engage with the Olympics. We were very lucky in that there's a very obvious way to look at sport and to use design as the lens through which to look at sport. So I think that was perhaps the genesis and the start point of the exhibition. I mean, I think it's important to say that it's not an exhibition about the Olympics, it's about sport in general. So we've got a whole range of sports in here, almost anything that you can think of. So we've tried to not limit ourselves by looking at any one particular thing.
You're trying to marry the world of design and sport. And how do you think design has helped shape the sporting world?
Well, I don't think you can really look at sport without looking at design. I mean, it's changed almost every aspect of sport. I mean, down to how we play sport, how it's governed, and how we watch it. So, I mean, to trace the history of sport is also to trace the history of how design has influenced it. I mean, even if you look back to the early Greeks at the original sort of Greek Hellenic Olympics almost, where they developed systems where they used to swing weights in either hand to gain an advantage over standing start jumps. You can see these design innovations coming in right at the beginning of sports, so I think it's impossible to separate the two.
You've got several different themes in the exhibition, so you've got safety, fashion, technology, performance, new materials. How did you put all these ideas together when you were originally planning the exhibition?
Well, I mean, I think it's a balancing act, and it's the same with any exhibition. You look at the content that you'd like to show, you look at the stories that are available with that content, and you kind of come up with some kind of narrative in the middle between those two things. Sometimes you have these wonderful ideas and narratives that you'd love to create, and the exhibits just aren't there to tell those stories. So I think you have to work at both ends of the scale and end up with something in the middle, so you sort of do start to speak to lenders and manufacturers and see what could be available to show and then what narratives can be created from within that.
You've shown me some incredible things here today. We've got the F1 car that won the Le Mans race. We've got some rowing boats. We've got various bicycles. How easy or difficult was it to persuade people to give you these things?
Some things have been easier than others. I think one of the challenges for this exhibition is that it's a very busy time for people in the sporting profession. They've got a lot of priorities, and trying to convince people that this is high up on their priorities list wasn't always easy. Sometimes it was very easy and people were really keen to be involved. Other times we had to show them why it would be a really good opportunity. And I think once you talk to the manufacturers and the designers and the developers involved and they realise the scale of the exhibition that we're putting together and some of the other exhibits that are going to be in it, everyone's been really keen to be involved. So I think it's actually about trying to work with the lenders and the manufacturers to show them what you're trying to achieve.
You mentioned this isn't an exhibition about the Olympics, but clearly it's a great time for the exhibition to be on. Many tourists in London. Are you hoping to have a lot of athletes and sports fans come and learn a bit more?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we're lucky in that design straddles so many different areas, so we have quite a wide kind of visitor basis anyway. But sport is an area that it's wonderful that we can actually tap into perhaps a type of visitor that wouldn't necessarily come to the museum beforehand. So that's a really good opportunity for us. So yeah, we're very much hoping to.
What are you hoping that people will take away from the exhibition after they've seen it?
Well, I suppose, as we said at the beginning, that a realisation that design is fundamental in all aspects of sports, even if it's just looking at how shoes that are used for particular sports are incredibly designed for that bespoke purpose, or the gloves that people wear, or the protection that they use. I mean, even down to how modern day cameras can capture fouls and things like that in football changes the way that sports are played and sports are governed. Lots of rules in sports have been changed according to sort of design innovations, material innovations. So it affects almost every single element of sport, and I think that's what I'd like the visitors to take away with them.
You just showed me two rowing boats. One was from 1900 and one was from very recently. They don't look that different. It's very interesting to see two things that are so far apart in age look so similar, and that's probably something that you're hoping people will learn.
Yeah, I think there's a huge amount of similarities between those two exhibits. I think the difference is things that you don't see, perhaps, such as the materials that are involved in the manufacture of it, whereas the original one is made from balsa wood and plywood, and the modern one's made from a sort of honeycomb mixture of carbon fibre and Kevlar. So it's a huge difference in terms of how they're put together and how they weigh and how they perform. But to the naked eye, in terms of the shape and the structure and the lines of the two boats, they're very similar.
You also showed me the Speedo swimming costume exhibit. You mentioned that full body suits have now been banned for athletes, and Speedo have now developed a new suit which mimics shark skin?
Well, shark skin was one of their original suits that they developed, the fast skin. The current suit that they've done is actually responding to new FINA guidelines that they had to change when FINA outlawed unnatural or non-woven fibres in full-length bodysuits. So their new suit is called the Fast Skin 3, and they've actually looked at developing a system whereby the goggles, the cap and the suit all work together as a sort of combined system. I think traditionally those three different pieces have been designed very separately, but Speedo have actually for the first time looked at sort of designing them as a complete system. And I think one of the important things is that it's sculpted to the body in very particular ways. So they have different panels of different fibres and fabrics within it. So they have to sit in very careful and precise positions on the body. So they're very carefully marked and tagged in order for the athletes to put them on in the right way.
You've had Stella McCartney contribute to the exhibition and Yohji Yamamoto. What's your personal favourite part of the exhibition?
Well, I mean, I think there are some wonderful big exhibits that are very hard to miss. As you say, there's the Audi that won Le Mans this year and the Formula One's car. So, I mean, there are wonderful big exhibits like that. But I think my favourite exhibits are probably the bicycles. There's something about a bicycle that's such an enduring piece of engineering. We recognise the bicycle, we see it, everyone knows how they work, and even one that's incredibly high-tech and well-engineered, hugely well thought out, I mean, you can still read the mechanics in it. You can understand how the legs go through the pedals and the energy is transferred through the gearing and the power drive goes through to the rear wheel. It's a system that we can read, and for that reason I think they're my favourite objects. It's sports everywhere, it's kind of omnipresent, and I think it's so hard to have a cultural force in our lives that doesn't affects other areas as well. I mean, I think fashion's perhaps the most obvious example of this, and we can see things like trainers being on the high street. You can see how sports silhouettes have actually been combined into fashion and leisure trainers, and I think that's very interesting. But you can even see it in art, you can see it in advertising, you can see it in so many areas of our life.
That was Monocle's Emily Aylett getting sporty at the Design Museum in London. More on that in a bit, but first, a short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Premiering on monocle.com, a film about the city we feel ranks number one for quality of life. Monocle's annual survey goes beyond the basic economic and social aspects of a city, identifying often overlooked factors that can bring happiness and ease to everyday life. And for the second time running, climbing back up to the number one spot, it's Zurich.
On a sunny early summer's day in Zurich, a handful of its residents have made their way to Badi Enge, one of several bathing houses situated along the waterfront, offering decks for sunbathing, bars, and even saunas. The scene is especially notable for taking place minutes from downtown, and it's what sets Zurich immediately apart. This is a city with abundant and interconnected green space, cut through by rivers leading to its lake. All of it set up to be enjoyed by the population.
You can watch this film plus our top 25 most livable city countdown on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D. From London, we're off to Portugal, to Lisbon, to the studio of local architects Aires Mateus. The brothers at the helm of the practice are known and admired for their minimalist buildings, which belie a complex technical manoeuvring of material, light and landscape. One brother, Francisco Aires Mateus, tells Saima Tariq what he thinks good architecture is about, and he talks about his upcoming work for the Venice Architecture Biennale.
It's central for our work, and sometimes we try to deriver a little bit from this sense, and then we always do the effort to come back and to clearly design architecture for people, for life.
Francisco Aires Mateus is chatting to me in his Lisbon studio, down the road from his brother Manuel's office. Though they work apart, together they have won a number of awards globally, with their work the subject of recent monographs by El Corquis and Habitar. They are part of a fascinating moment in their native Portugal, a small country full of rising architecture stars who, despite diminishing commissions, are achieving international recognition.
It is, for me, as I believe for lots of people, a surprise. Because there is no organized effort for things to be that way. And I believe, in a way, it happens because of Caesar. I mean, we have a standard, and that's what's good with Eros. I mean, you establish a kind of a level. You know you will not reach it, but you will try. But it's true, there is a lot of good architecture in Portugal. And if you remember that we are only 9 million, and you see from the average how many good architects are in Portugal, it's amazing. Unfortunately, nobody cares, because architecture in Portugal, it's just regarded, from the institutional point of view, as a business.
You say there are many good architects here. What is good architecture for you?
In a way, it's architecture that works with the real values of architecture. I mean, this is a stupid answer, but it's like it's written in the Peter Sundor's text, which is to say that architecture should deal with architectural aspects, not others. This means that architecture should deal mainly with life, which is its purpose. And then it should be built with light, space, and material. The problem is that in so many other ways of thinking, and I wouldn't dare to say they are wrong, people is trying to fill architecture with lots of subjects. And we assisted some years ago that architecture was always justified through philosophy. And other people justified architecture through images, or fairy tales, or in the postmodern moments. And I mean, all these subjects are part of architecture, but they are not architecture itself. So architecture is about these very simple things, and it's about the same issues that it was in the Roman period, or before, I mean, just to give an example. You get into Rome in the Pantheon, and it's all there. I mean, tectonics, material, space, light. You can use all the justifications, God, the rain, the gods, one god, several gods. I mean, all the cultural excuses, you can use it. But what remains is that.
Recent works by Aires Mateus have included a long chain-like elderly home that allows for both privacy and community and is topographically in tune with its surroundings. A call centre that marks a transition between the urban and the natural, and whose atmosphere changes as the day passes. And a Rossi-style town residence that is as deceptive in its appearance as it is surreal. White walls, sequential blocks and almost miraculous techniques concerning natural light are apparent studio trademarks. Now, the brothers are poised and willing to produce work outside of Portugal. They are starting somewhat this summer, having been invited by David Chipperfield to produce a pavilion for the Venice Biennale.
What we have is a kind of almost a primitive shelter, which is the first architectural gesture of humanity, which is to protect, and can be written as a rich bus stop or a boat stop, because we are in Venice. You can imagine a cube which is excavated with these round spaces. And what we did is to generate a certain tension between the places in which people can use and the places that are, let's say, cantilevered over the water and absorb the reflection of the sun in the water, in the golden surfaces. It has no treatment, so it will rust with time. And underneath these carved cupolas are all golden. So we expect to have also a certain welcoming light underneath this shelter. I've never seen such covered docks like Dozita. It's an incredible space. We could not actually use the place underneath the cover because it's full of water, obviously. Our piece is just attached to the limit of these docks. So what we're trying to do is to also to claim some attention and to kind of use almost the same strategy of the covered docks. So it's a precise piece for a precise place. And obviously the ambience at the Arsenale vanishes altogether, because it brings heritage, it brings construction, it brings tectonics, it brings all the life connected with the water, which is very powerful in Venice. Obviously, in Venice, everything is very powerful, but in a way, it's the industrial part of Venice that also comes out in that place. So that's very powerful. It's not the fancy Venice. It's the other one, which is as beautiful as the first. I mean, this is the kind of thing that I aim to do. This is great. You get total freedom. You explore things. And in our architecture, it's important that we claim the possibility of mistaking, because it's the only way to go ahead. Because we keep on calling the work in architecture research. And if you think of a biologist, he makes mistakes. So we claim the right to do mistakes. In a way, it's easier if you make a mistake on things like this, because you will dismantle it, and that's okay. So this is very important for us. Of course, there are lots of things that I would like to do in life. I would like to do projects in lots of places. I would love, obviously, to do a project in New York. The project I would like to do more in my life would be the Serpentine Gallery. It's something that I find incredible. Because in a way, it touches these subjects. You can do things. You can try. You can fail, even.
For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Simon Tarry.
And staying in Lisbon, here's Angolan Portuguese Batilda with Usponema. That was Usponema by Batilda. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Airports, for all the time we spend in them, can be grisly places. You don't need me to point out the endless queues, the grumpy below-par service, and the shoddy operation systems. But with ever-increasing levels of air travel, the airport experience is something that's thankfully being addressed. A new exhibition in Denver, Colorado, showcases the efforts of a local architect and looks at the best in airport design, from past to present and future. We sent our correspondent Zachary Barr along to take a look.
The show is called Now Boarding. It casts a bright light on airport architect Kurt Fentress. More about him and his work later. First, let's enter the exhibit.
When visitors first come into the exhibition, they see a work of art, and it's called Getaway.
That's the show's curator, Donald Albrecht. He's going to be our tour guide. In front of us is a movie being projected onto the wall.
And what you see literally is landing at an airport. It's the view from the cockpit, which is not a view that the average passenger ever gets.
In other words, the film shows the point of view of the airplane, and it plays in super slow motion. So it feels a little like a dream. A dream with a really cool soundtrack. You could say that this music and the art that accompanies it evokes air travel's golden era, when all stewardesses were leggy, all passengers dapper, and all meals sirloin. This show touches on that era. There's a sexy collection of vintage stewardesses' uniforms, but it's mostly about airports, so let's stay on point. First stop, a historical timeline. Airports begin to grow up.
So, for example, runway lighting, when was that introduced that allowed us to fly at night?
Runway lighting happened around 1930, perhaps first in Cleveland, Ohio.
When was the jetway introduced?
Jetways, 1960 or so, in California.
When were moving sidewalks introduced?
And moving sidewalks, 1958, Love Field, Dallas, Texas.
All these things that we take for granted actually occurred at some point in history.
Let's skip ahead to the 1970s. Flying gets really popular. Cities need new, larger airports. And so just like that, bad airports are born.
Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport, which is completed in the early 1980s, it is designed in a very anonymous way and is a giant people processor.
Atlanta's problem is one of design. The airport is a big box filled with endless, fluorescently lit corridors.
The worst one I found always is in Paris.
George Eich from Germany was touring the exhibit. His least favorite airport, Paris's De Gaulle and Orly, suffer from a different problem.
I think probably what it is, you know, they added on. That was not a master plan right from the beginning. And then, of course, if you add on, you add on, you know, and then, of course, it's always a compromise.
He's right. London's Heathrow also fits this description. So, to review, here's what we've learned. Don't design your airport in the shape of a giant box, and always build from the ground up. Got it? Okay. Now we're ready to talk about the good airports. Cue the music. Here's architect Kurt Fentress.
The design of a building, at least for me, is like writing music. And the writing of music is for the listener. And so it's for the buildings are for the people.
Kurt Fentress built Denver's airport, DIA. It opened in 1995, and it's best known for its white tented roof. The roof makes you think about the snow-capped mountains nearby, and Indian teepees, which are no longer nearby. Kurt Fentress says public architecture should relate to the place and its culture.
We also try to discover what we call the natural order. The natural order or flow in a building is the purpose of that building. And that natural flow, if it can be made really simple and easy to understand, makes the experience of the user of the building much greater and makes it easier.
After Fentress designed DIA, other people wanted him to design their airports too. One is Incheon International Airport in Seoul, South Korea. Curator Albrecht says, just like in Denver, look to the roof to see Fentress's signature touch. In this case, it's a curved roof.
And that curve is determined in many ways by the curving roof of traditional Korean architecture. Also at this airport, once you go in, there's all kinds of Korean cultural events that take place. So it's an international building type, but you get some feeling of being in Korea by going through this airport.
Do you think the average visitor to this South Korea airport makes that connection?
Probably not.
Yeah.
But Kurt has said that when he showed it to the Korean officials, they understood it.
And in that way, architecture maybe is a little bit like poetry or literature.
Yeah, right. Architecture operates on different levels and different frequencies. And this airport may mean something to some people and other things to other people. What people probably most remember about it, though, is because it's rather narrow, the distance from the curbside to the airside is relatively short, and you can move through it rather quickly.
And boarding your plane without much fuss is what we really care about. So good thing Kurt Fentress is on our side.
If you're going to the airport, you're going to catch an airplane. And so that building is about helping make that as easy and as comfortable and as clear as possible.
Fentress' latest design is in Los Angeles, where he's designing the new international terminal at LAX. Its roof will be wave-like, a nod to the Pacific Ocean. The terminal is supposed to open next year. And well, to end this story, let's look farther ahead to the airport of the future. Surprisingly, it's pretty simple. Imagine this. Planes that can take off and land vertically. I'm talking about straight up and down. So runways are no longer needed, which is all to say the airport of the future, it doesn't really look much like an airport at all. In Denver, for Monocle, I'm Zachary Barr.
Flying out of Denver, we're back in London next. But first, a short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
It's that time of year when Monocle packs its trunks and its bikinis and heads to the beach to produce our summer resort newspaper, Monocle Mediterraneo. Our large format paper takes the temperature of the region from Liguria to Lebanon, Marseille to Mallorca.
In the affairs section, we head to gritty Marseille, even grittier Baalbek, and I had the rather arduous task of a road trip along the Adriatic.
In the business section this month, we start off in Libya to look at how small businesses are playing a big role in the country's recovery. We also have a special report on the boat builders of the Bosphorus as the Turkish luxury yacht industry finally comes of age. And as always, we'll be doing our annual roundup of Pitti Uomo in Florence to see the very best that the menswear industry has to offer.
In the culture section, because someone had to do it, we found the beach clubs that turned into nightclubs in Beirut, Turkey and Menorca. And we scanned the musical globe for the perfect summer playlist.
In the design section, we discover a modernist neighbourhood in Naples, a mid-century gem in Ibiza, and a cool stone creation on Mykonos.
And we head to Tuscany to find out where US soldiers unwind on Europe's only US military-controlled beach.
Monocle Mediterraneo is on newsstands now. It's the only beach companion you'll need this summer.
Welcome back to Section D. We're back in London now, and last week, at the Conran shop in Chelsea, an interesting panel discussion chewed over the relationship between digital technology and luxury. It was called Precious Pixels, Towards a New Digital Luxury. Our own Nelly Gocheva was in attendance, and afterwards she sat down with panellist Nancy Tilbury, director of fashion technology company Studio XO, and the event's host, Daljit Singh, creative director of interactive design agency Conran Singh.
We've worked a lot with musical artists, which has been quite a fascinating journey. In the last couple of years, we've been working with the Black Eyed Peas. We did their stage costumes. And what was unique about our work compared to maybe some of the other people in the field is we really wanted to look at how display was placed on the body. And more from a fashion perspective than a technology perspective. So if we were going to communicate with the audience through the stage, how could we synchronize this in a way that was really meaningful? And so we developed a system that corresponded to the whole stage setting. So if you like, we built antennas inside clothing that as the artists hit the stage, there was this huge impact for the audience. So design drove the technology. I think that's what's unique about what we're doing in our company, that there is it is as much about design and design articulation as it is about coders and engineers. You know, we operate in that gray space. So we hope the products that come out are, you know, they're really realistic and tangible in terms of what wearable tech can be.
In terms of audience and, let's say, the future of this, how do we bring technology and luxury together? Because they seem kind of worlds apart.
Well, I think, again, talking about sort of intimacy, and, you know, where there's been, you know, this kind of product revolution in terms of the Audrino and the lily pad and customization, we're at a stage where we have this sort of recipe of parts. And you know, in a way, the technology has become flexible and affordable enough, but not necessarily for the masses at this point. And I think the luxury market could be a real catalyst for these kind of new super surfaces that we're talking about inventing. So if you like, you know, if a textile, or, you know, if diamonds are pixels, if you like, the most appropriate place is the luxury market. That's the place to start, and then you can see how that would disseminate out into the masses.
I think the future is about technology becoming more and more invisible. It's not about buttons, I think it's about gestures, and I think it's about experience, and I think it's about personalization, where technology actually intertwines itself with the real things that we surround us. So buildings, to carpets, to the clothes that we wear and the things that we use, and possibly even the food that we eat.
the talk was called Precious Pixels, and we're talking about luxury brands and digital technology. How does technology fit with luxury exactly?
Well, I think, again, from the debate this evening, it's quite a challenge because, and I fundamentally believe one of the problems is that the people who make technology and the people who make luxury don't talk to one another because they occupy very different worlds and probably get up and go to bed at very different times. However, I think we're beginning to see there's a beauty in technology, which, you know, Apple have obviously created. However, I think people are going to get bored of that. They're going to want more different experiences, which are a lot more personal and a lot more intimate. And that's where I think luxury brands have an extraordinary possibility of engaging with technology and making technology work in innovative ways. And I think innovative is the important word here, because I think innovation isn't happening with those big organizations. They're about mass production. And I think luxury, because it can be quite bijou, it can be quite beautiful, and it can be quite small, can take technology into a new dimension.
That was Nelly Gochiva at the Conran Shop in London, talking with Nancy Tilbury and Daljit Singh at the Precious Pixels panel discussion last week. Time now for our weekly drop-in on one of the architecture and design showcases happening in tandem with the Olympics. This time we're off to the Austrian Cultural Forum to hear about their urban sports pockets.
We looked at the concept of how people play with buildings in any city, really. And it started with the concept that the feet of a building are where people enter the building. But also we established that in some areas, and a wonderful example of this is the South Bank Centre in London, where they actually play with the fabric of a city, whether it be their skateboards riding up against the columns and the ramps that are created there and the steps, or whether it be parkour runners that are jumping over parapets and walls and roofs of buildings. So we'd identified that people do play with the city. And then as the exhibition was for the Austrian Cultural Forum, we decided to look at the comparison between London and Vienna. They're two capital cities, but actually the similarities pretty much end there, in that one has a population of about 8 million, the other 1.5, almost 2. So huge difference in size, in population, and you would consider London almost as a, you know, it's a metropole, it's a world city, one of the top three, you could argue. The difference was that the Viennese seemed to have a better care for their urban environment, or urban realm, as we call it. And we found that where London, the places that people played the sport were more impromptu and they were often moved on by security guards, the Viennese government, or more the Viennese mayoralty, decided that if they were finding people were playing a sport, they would actually encourage it, but also protect it. And we found that actually, whereby on a square between buildings, kids might have been playing football, and it was close to a road, that actually, because it was close to a road, it was a danger, and the Austrians would actually create an enclosure. They would create something called cages, they got called. The funny thing was that in this enclosure, the people who actually created the enclosures put a huge sign over the fence and labelled them freedom cages. So within the enclosure, they were finding the freedom to live and to play with their city. So in a way, those cages have become urban sport venues. So people have always played with their cities, we found. We're just a snapshot of how people are playing it today. And how God knows how they play it in the future. It's interesting, and we feel it's a wonderful snapshot of today, a moment. 2012, the summer 2012, before the Olympics, we can see not only how the people of London and Vienna, but specifically London, are going to be using the venues, the athletes come from far away, it's how the inhabitants of our capital city are playing sport in their own backyard.
That was Emily Aylett reporting at the Austrian Cultural Forum in London. And that brings us neatly to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we'll be exploring the design community in Buenos Aires. We'll be hearing the many sounds that craftsmen make in London, with Dominic Wilcox, who's meticulously recorded them. And we'll find out why one man in Macedonia is so obsessed with matchboxes. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills and edited by Sam Impey. I'm Hugo MacDonald. This is Our Day Will Come.